Ekatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive.
Today we're doing something a bit different. It's like an archaeological dig, but into the human mind itself.
Yeah, and our guide is this incredible book, Francis Yates' The Art of Memory.
And we're not just talking about, you know, remembering facts for a test.
Oh, no, this is way bigger.
Yates argues that for centuries, memory wasn't just a tool. It was like the operating system, the whole internal architecture of Western thought.
That's really the core mission for you, the listener, today. Yeah. We're trying to uncover what feels like a lost continent of the mind, almost.
A lost continent. I like that.
Because Yates shows us this art of memory, mnemotechnics, they called it. Wasn't some party trick, you know, or just a study aid.
Right.
It was fundamental. It shaped their philosophy, their art, their religion, even how they built buildings.
And it answers this huge question that we barely think about now with smartphones and everything.
Mm-hmm. How do people organize just vast amounts of knowledge before the printing press, before you could just look stuff up?
Exactly.
And the answer is fascinating because it wasn't like dry and logical. It was visual, spatial, theatrical even.
And often really weird, which turns out to be important.
Okay, yeah. This is where it gets really interesting.
So to really get this book, you kind of need to know about the author, Dame Frances Amelia Yates.
Right.
Born 1899, spent most of her career at the Warburg Institute in London.
And they specialize in that whole intersection of art, religion, magic, especially in the Renaissance, don't they?
Precisely. And that background is key to why her view was so, well, revolutionary.
How so?
Well, before Yates, most historians kind of filed away things like Hermeticism, Neoplatonism, alchemy.
The mystical stuff.
Yeah, the mystical stuff. They treated it as, you know, historical quirks or just superstition, not serious intellectual work.
Things smart people grew out of.
Right. But Yates completely flipped that. She said, no, wait a minute. These were complex, serious, integrated intellectual systems.
Her whole thing was digging into this occult philosophy she believed was the hidden engine, really, driving a lot of the Renaissance.
So she saw the Renaissance not just as like rediscovering Greek logic, but as this deeply mystical, ambitious time.
Exactly. And because she had that lens, she could see that the art of memory wasn't just some technique.
It was the key.
It was the key, the organizing principle for that whole pre-modern way of thinking.
Okay, let's unpack that central idea of the art of memory then. What's the core argument?
The core argument is beautiful, really. It's that the history of how we remember is tied up completely with the history of how we think, how we believe, how we understand our place in the universe.
So the method they used to train memory,
right,
it wasn't just about recall.
No. It was actually a method for ordering all knowledge,
right,
for ordering reality itself in a way.
Oh, okay. And the basic technique is this memory palace thing, right? The method of loci.
That's the foundation, yes. You need two basic things. First, the loci.
The places. The places, exactly. A familiar, fixed architectural space you can walk through clearly in your mind. Your house, maybe a temple, a street you know well, has to be ordered.
Okay, got the place. What's the second thing?
The second thing is the imagines. The images. These represent the things you want to remember.
But not just any images, right?
Definitely not. They have to be converted into really striking, vivid, emotionally charged visuals. They're often called imagines agents, active images.
Active, like moving.
Yeah, or doing something, personified. Yeah. The more vivid, unusual, maybe even grotesque or beautiful the image, the better it sticks.
Because the mundane gets forgotten.
Exactly. And this whole process let them map huge fields of knowledge onto these mental spaces.
And the book traces how this idea evolved.
Right. It starts out really practical with Roman speakers.
Or speeches and stuff.
Yeah. Then it becomes a moral guide in the Middle Ages. And then in the Renaissance, it goes completely off the charts into, well, magic and cosmology.
Quite a journey.
A huge intellectual arc.
So let's start at the beginning, like the book does. Classical origins. There's that famous story, isn't there? Simonides.
Ah, yes. The legend of Simonides of Ceos, the Greek poet. He's at some big banquet.
Right.
He steps outside for a moment and bam, the roof collapses, crushes everyone inside. Horrific.
Terrible story, but important for memory.
Crucial, because Simonides, standing outside, was apparently the only one who could identify the mangled bodies afterwards.
Oh.
By remembering exactly where each person had been sitting, in their ordered place at the table.
Ah, the spatial order.
That's it. That became the core principle. Order in space is the key to order in memory.
And the Romans turned this into a formal system.
They did. They codified it. You find the rules in books like the Ad Herennium.
What kind of rules?
Well, at the loci, the places had to be distinct, well-lit. You follow them in a fixed order. But the rules for the imagines, the images, that's where it gets really interesting.
You said they had to be striking.
Oh, yeah. They had to be active, unusual, beautiful or grotesque, maybe bloody or comical or tragic.
Why so dramatic?
Because the Roman rhetoricians figured something out early on. We forget the ordinary. We remember what shocks us, what moves us, what's bizarre.
That sounds surprisingly modern, like psychology.
It really does. It's deep cognitive insight. Centuries ago.
Okay, so fast forward maybe 1,000 years. Middle Ages. Christianity is dominant. How does this very pagan Roman art survive?
Well, as Yeats puts it, it gets baptized.
Baptized.
Yeah. Thinkers like Thomas Aquinas, the big scholastic philosopher, they integrated the classical art into the Christian framework.
But the purpose must have changed, right? It's not about winning debates anymore.
Completely changed. It's no longer about worldly success. It's about spiritual salvation, about saving your soul.
So how does that change the memory palace itself? What are the loci now?
Instead of a Roman villa, the loci become allegorical structures. Mental cathedrals, maybe, or even maps of heaven and hell and purgatory.
Wow.
And you use these mental spaces to memorize virtues and vices, prayers, points of doctrine. Memory training becomes part of being virtuous. It gets linked to the cardinal virtue of prudence, the idea that you need to remember past moral lessons to make good decisions now and for the future.
Okay, that makes sense. A smooth shift from rhetoric to morality. But then the Renaissance hits, and you said things go off the rails from morality to magic.
Pretty much. The goal shifts again, radically. It's less about remembering the world as it is and more about magically interacting with it, maybe even controlling it.
What drove that change?
A big part was the rediscovery of ancient Hermetic texts. These texts talked a lot about the connection between man, the microcosm, and the universe, the macrocosm, the idea that one reflects the other.
And this leads to things like Camillo's memory theater. That sounds wild.
It is wild. Giulio Camillo, 16th century Italy, he designed and partly built an actual physical wooden amphitheater.
A real theater?
Yeah, but the setup was reversed. Instead of an audience looking at a stage, there was one spectator standing on the stage.
Looking out.
Looking out at the tiers of seats. And these tiers weren't empty. They were covered in images.
What kind of images?
Images representing the entire structure of the cosmos. Planetary spheres, elements, everything. All laid out systematically.
So one person stands there basically staring at a map of the universe.
That was the idea. And the goal wasn't just recall anymore. By standing there, absorbing this perfect cosmic map, Camillo believed the spectator could attain universal knowledge, divine understanding.
Architecture as a tool for enlightenment.
You could say that. Architecture as an instrument of divine revelation, almost.
Okay, but Yeats's real centerpiece, the figure who takes this to the absolute extreme, is Giordano Bruno.
Bruno, yes. The Dominican friar turned, well, hermetic magus. He's the climax of the story in many ways.
And he paid the price for it. Burned for heresy. How did he connect the memory palace to magic?
Bruno basically fuses everything together. He takes the memory palace structure, merges it with complex combinatorial systems from Ramon Lull.
Who's Ramon Lull?
A medieval philosopher with these rotating wheels to combine concepts. Bruno mixes that with really deep astrological and hermetic symbolism. It's incredibly complex.
But what was the core magical idea? What made it heresy?
The core was his choice of imagines. He used powerful astrological symbols, talismans, figures from Egyptian magic.
Why those specific images?
Because in the Hermetic view, these weren't just symbols. They were channels for actual cosmic forces.
Okay.
So Bruno believed that by constructing a perfect, intricate memory palace using these potent symbols, he wasn't just organizing information. He was organizing his own mind, the microcosm.
To mirror the universe.
Yeah.
The macrocosm.
Precisely. To perfectly mirror it. And if his mind perfectly mirrored the cosmos, he believed he could gain access to its powers.
So the memory system becomes an internal magic wand.
That's a good way to put it. An inner magical instrument. A pathway to gnosis, direct divine knowledge and power. It wasn't just retention. It was about becoming godlike.
Becoming the world, not just remembering it.
Exactly. And that level of magical ambition, that claim to manipulating the cosmos through his mind, rooted in this transformed art of memory. That is largely why the Inquisition condemned him.
It wasn't just his astronomy about infinite worlds.
That was part of it, but Yates argues compellingly that the magical memory system was central to the heresy charges.
Okay, so this incredibly powerful tradition, shaping thought for 2,000 years, basically dies out in the 17th century. What killed it? Yates points to two big things, right?
Two major forces, yeah. The first one is pretty straightforward. Technology.
The printing press.
The printing press. Yeah. Suddenly, knowledge is externalized on a massive scale. You don't need to build these colossal memory structures inside your head anymore.
The library is outside you now, not inside.
Right. The urgent, practical need just diminished significantly.
It makes sense. But the second cause is deeper, more philosophical.
Much deeper. It's the scientific revolution, and particularly the rise of a new kind of rationalist philosophy. Think René Descartes.
I think, therefore I am.
That guy. Descartes championed clear, distinct ideas. Mathematics. Logic. He had absolutely no time for the core engine of the old art.
Which was?
The vivid, emotional, often bizarre imagination. Those imagined sessions.
So the new science rejected imagination as a tool for knowing.
Totally. It was seen as fuzzy, unreliable, irrational, antithetical to finding clear, objective truth. Descartes wanted pure reason.
And others too, like Francis Bacon.
Absolutely. Bacon pushed for empirical observation, experiments. He dismissed all the cosmic symbolism and Neoplatonic stuff that Renaissance magi loved as basically nonsense, fantasy.
So the imaginative, theatrical, emotional memory palace gets dismantled, replaced by cold, hard reason and observation.
That's the shift, a fundamental break. The rejection of imagination as a valid epistemological tool is huge.
Wow. It really makes you rethink the history of science and thought. So pulling back, what are the big takeaways from this lost history for us today, living in our own information age?
Well, the first key theme has to be the sheer power Yates reveals in imagination as a way of knowing.
As an epistemological tool, you say.
Exactly. For the pre-modern mind, vivid emotional imagination wasn't just for art or fantasy. It was a vital tool for grasping and retaining truth.
And the reflection for us is,
we totally underestimate the power of visual emotional encoding today, don't we? We try to brute force memorize dry facts.
We treat memory like a hard drive, not a theater.
That's a great way to put it. The second theme is memory as this fundamental organizing principle for knowledge.
The first database.
Pretty much. The memory palace was the mental architecture you could map everything onto: philosophy, law, medicine. It shows this deep human need to structure information, to give it a place.
And that need hasn't gone away, has it? We just use different methods now. Folders, databases, algorithms.
The methods change. The underlying need for structure remains.
And the third theme, which you flag as provocative.
Yeah.
The connection between magic, religion, and science.
Yeah, Yates really challenges the neat boxes we put these things into.
How so?
She shows how the intense desire of someone like Bruno, the Renaissance magus, to create this perfectly organized system to understand and control nature.
That sounds kind of scientific in a way.
It's the ambition that's similar, right? That ambition is a direct psychological precursor to the ambition of the early scientists. Both wanted universal order and, frankly, control. They just had different toolkits, magical symbols versus mathematical equations and experiments.
Knowledge progresses in strange, tangled ways.
Very tangled, not a straight line at all.
The book is just packed with these moments. Let's maybe highlight a few specific ideas or quotes that really capture Yates' argument.
Okay. One key idea is just correcting our modern view. We think memory techniques are trivial. Yates says, no, think of this quote, paraphrased. The classical art of memory wasn't about remembering shopping lists. It was about retaining the structure and substance of entire fields of knowledge.
So it was serious business, foundational to education.
Absolutely. Then there's the Renaissance shift. What was the goal then? This sums it up. For Giordano Bruno, the art of memory was no longer about remembering the world, but about becoming the world. His memory system was a magical religious technique.
Aiming for transformation, union with the divine, not just recall.
Exactly. It's about the soul's journey.
And that amazing psychological insight from way back.
Right, from the Roman rhetoric books. The memory image must be strikingly beautiful or singularly ugly, comic or tragic. The images formed must not be usual ones.
Because weirdness sticks.
They knew it. It perfectly anticipates modern psychology, like the von Ristorff effect, the fact that unusual things are easier to remember. They understood the power of the bizarre for cognition.
Amazing. Okay, let's make this practical. How can someone listening right now actually use some of these ideas, this lost art, in our totally different world?
Well, The most direct application is dusting off the loci method itself, especially for complex stuff.
Like for a presentation or learning something new.
Exactly. If you're prepping a big meeting or trying to get your head around a complex process, try visualizing it as a journey through a familiar place, your house, your office commute.
And place key points along the way.
Yes. At specific spots that don't move. Anchor the concepts in space. It really works.
And we need to bring back the imagines agentes, the active images.
Definitely. Stop trying to memorize abstract terms or dry data as words. Translate them.
Into what?
Into vivid, concrete, maybe even ridiculous visual stories. Don't just memorize supply chain logistics. Picture, I don't know, a frantic manager juggling boxes while riding a unicycle down your hallway.
Make it weird. Make it move.
Make it memorable. And maybe a third thing, on a slightly deeper level.
Yeah.
Just appreciate the metaphors we still use that come from this. When we talk about a field of study or building an argument or looking for a framework.
Those are spatial metaphors.
They are. Recognizing that history, that our minds naturally organize knowledge spatially, can actually help you structure your own thinking more intentionally.
That's a great point. Thinking about this whole journey, what surprised you the most reading Yeats?
You know, for me, it was probably how explicit the rejection of imagination was by the founders of the scientific revolution.
By Descartes and Bacon.
Yeah, that they consciously had to dismantle this 2,000-year-old cognitive toolkit, this reliance on imagery and emotion to build their new system of reason, trading that inner theater for logic. It felt quite radical.
It really reframes the birth of modernity.
It does, and I think that leads to the final thought for you, the listener. Yeats gives us this profound paradigm shift.
Which is?
That our modern quest, this relentless drive for perfectly organized, all-encompassing systems of knowledge, you know, the dream behind big data, AI.
The quest for the ultimate database.
Right. That quest isn't new at all. It has ancient roots, deeply human, sometimes mystical roots back in this old art, this desire to map the entire cosmos inside our own minds.
A powerful connection between the ancient art and our digital age.
Absolutely.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.